What Cohen and Nesbitt were seeing in that long haul was the culture of honor in action. The Southerners were reacting like Wicks Howard did when Little Bob Turner accused him of cheating at poker. That study is strange, isn't it? It's one thing to conclude that groups of people living in circumstances pretty similar to their ancestors act a lot like their ancestors. But those Southerners in the hallway study weren't living in circumstances similar to their British ancestors. They didn't even necessarily have British ancestors. They just happened to have grown up in the South. None of them were herdsmen, nor were their parents herdsmen. They were living in the late 20th century, not the late 19th century. They were students at the University of Michigan in one of the northernmost states in America, which meant that they were sufficiently cosmopolitan to travel hundreds of miles from the South to go to college. And none of that mattered. They still acted like they were living in 19th century Harlan, Kentucky. Your median student in these studies comes from a family making over $100,000, and that's in 1990 dollars, Cohen says. The Southerners we see this effect with aren't kids who come from the hills of Appalachia. They're more likely to be the sons of upper-middle management Coca-Cola executives in Atlanta. And that's the big question. Why should we get this effect with them? Why should one get it hundreds of years later? Why are these suburban Atlanta kids acting out the ethos of the frontier? Cultural legacies are powerful forces. They have deep roots and long lives. They persist generation after generation, virtually intact, even as the economic and social and demographic conditions that spawned them have vanished. And they play such a role in directing attitudes and behavior that we cannot make sense of our world without them. So far in Outliers, we've seen that success arises out of the steady accumulation of advantages. When and where you were born, and what your parents did for a living, and what the circumstances of your upbringing were like, all make a significant difference in how well you do in the world. The question for the second part of Outliers is whether the traditions and attitudes we inherit from our forebears can play the same role. Can we learn something about how people succeed and how to make people better at what they do by taking cultural legacies seriously? I think we can. Chapter 7. The Ethnic Theory of Plane Crashes. Captain, the weather radar has helped us a lot. On the morning of August 5, 1997, the captain of Korean Air Flight 801 woke at 6 a.m. His family would later tell investigators that he went to the gym for an hour, then came home and studied the flight plan for that evening's journey to Guam. He napped and ate lunch. At 3 in the afternoon, he left for Seoul, departing early enough, his wife said, to continue his preparations at Gimpo International Airport. He had been a pilot with Korean Air for almost 4 years after coming over from the Korean Air Force. He had 8,900 hours of flight time, including 3,200 hours of experience in jumbo jets. A few months earlier, he had been given a flight safety award by his airline for successfully handling a jumbo jet engine failure at low altitude. He was 42 years old and in excellent health. At 7 p.m., the captain, his first officer, and the flight engineer met and collected the trip's paperwork. They would be flying a Boeing 747, a model known in the aviation world as the Classic. The aircraft was in perfect working order. It had once been the Korean presidential plane. Flight 801 departed the gate at 10:30 in the evening and was airborne 20 minutes later. Takeoff was without incident. Just before 1:30 in the morning, the plane broke out of the clouds and the flight crew glimpsed lights off in the distance. "Is it Guam?" the flight engineer asked. Then, after a pause, he said, "It's Guam, Guam." The captain chuckled. "Good." The first officer reported to air traffic control that the airplane was clear of Charlie Bravo, cumulonimbus clouds, and requested radar vectors for runway 6 left. The plane began its descent towards Guam Airport. They would make a visual approach, the captain said. He had flown into Guam Airport from Gimpo 8 times previously, most recently a month ago, and he knew the airport and the surrounding terrain well. The landing gear went down. The flaps were extended 10 degrees. At 1:41 and 48 seconds, the captain said, "Wiper on," and the flight engineer turned them on. It was raining. The first officer then said, "Not in sight?" He was looking for the runway. He couldn't see it. 1 second later, the ground proximity warning system called out in its electronic voice, 500 feet. The plane was 500 feet off the ground. But how could that be if they couldn't see the runway? 2 seconds passed. The flight engineer said, "Eh?" in an astonished tone of voice. At 1:42 and 19 seconds, the first officer said, "Let's make a missed approach," meaning, "Let's pull up and make a large circle and try the landing again." 1 second later, the flight engineer said, "Not in sight." The first officer added, "Not in sight, missed approach." At 1:42 and 22 seconds, the flight engineer said, "Again, go around." At 1:42 and 23 seconds, the captain repeated, "Go around." But he was slow to pull the plane out of its descent. At 1:42 and 26 seconds, the plane hit the side of Nimitz Hill, a densely vegetated mountain 3 miles southwest of the airport. $60 million and 212,000 kilograms of steel slamming into rocky ground at 100 miles an hour. The plane skidded for 2,000 feet, severing an oil pipeline and snapping pine trees, before falling into a ravine and bursting into flames. By the time rescue workers reached the crash site, 228 of the 254 people on board were dead. 20 years before the crash of KL-801, a Korean Air Boeing 707 wandered into Russian airspace and was shot down by a military jet over the Barents Sea. It was an accident, meaning the kind of rare and catastrophic event that, for the grace of God, could happen to any airline. It was investigated and analyzed. Lessons were learned. Reports were filed. Then, 2 years later, a Korean Air Boeing 747 crashed in Seoul. Two accidents in 2 years is not a good sign. 3 years after that, the airline lost another 747 near Sakhalin Island in Russia, followed by a Boeing 707 that went down over the Andaman Sea in 1987, two more crashes in 1989 in Tripoli and Seoul, and then another in 1994 in Jeju, South Korea. To put that record in perspective, the loss rate for an airline like the American carrier United Airlines in the period 1988 to 1998 was 0.27 per million departures, which means that they lost a plane in an accident about once in every 4 million flights. The loss rate for Korean Air in the same period was 4.79 per million departures, 17 times higher. Korean Air's planes were crashing so often that when the National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, the U.S. agency responsible for investigating plane crashes within American jurisdiction, did its report on the Guam crash, it was forced to include an addendum listing all the new Korean Air accidents that had happened just since its investigation began. The Korean Air 747 that crash-landed at Gimpo in Seoul almost a year to the day after Guam, the jetliner that overran a runway at Korea's Ulsan Airport 8 weeks after that, the Korean Air McDonnell Douglas that rammed into an embankment at Pohang Airport the following March, and then, a month after that, the Korean Air passenger jet that crashed in a residential area of Shanghai. Had the NTSB waited just a few more months, it could have added another. The Korean Air cargo plane that crashed just after takeoff from London's Stansted Airport, despite the fact that a warning bell went off in the cockpit no fewer than 14 times. In April 1999, Delta Airlines and Air France suspended their flying partnership with Korean Air. In short order, the U.S. Army, which maintains thousands of troops in South Korea, forbade its personnel from flying with the airline. South Korea's safety rating was downgraded by the U.S. Federal Aviation Authority, and Canadian officials informed Korean Air's management that they were considering revoking the company's overflight and landing privileges in Canadian airspace. In the midst of the controversy, an outside audit of Korean Air's operations was leaked to the public. The 40-page report was quickly denounced by Korean Air officials as sensationalized and unrepresentative, but by that point it was too late to save the company's reputation. The audit detailed instances of flight crews smoking cigarettes on the tarmac during refueling and in the freight hold while the plane was in the air. Crew read newspapers throughout the flight, the audit stated, often with newspapers held up in such a way that if a warning light came on, it would not be noticed. The report detailed bad morale, numerous procedural violations, and the alarming conclusion that training standards for the 747 Classic were so poor that there is some concern as to whether first officers on the Classic fleet could land the aircraft if the captain became totally incapacitated with normal abnormal conditions. By the time of the Shanghai crash, the Korean president, Kim Dae-jung, felt compelled to speak up. "The issue of Korean Air is not a matter of an individual company, but a matter of the whole country," he said. "Our country's credibility is at stake." Dae-jung then switched the presidential plane from Korean Air to its new arrival, Asiana. But then, a small miracle happened. Korean Air turned itself around. Today, the airline is a member in good standing of the prestigious SkyTeam Alliance. Its safety record since 1999 is spotless. In 2006, Korean Air was given the Phoenix Award by Air Transport World in recognition of its transformation. Today, aviation experts will tell you that Korean Air is as safe as any airline in the world. In this chapter, we're going to conduct a crash investigation, listen to the black box cockpit recorder, examine the flight records, look at the weather and the terrain and the airport conditions, and compare the Guam crash to another very similar plane crash, all in an attempt to understand precisely how the company transformed itself from the worst kind of outlier into one of the world's best airlines. It is a complex and sometimes strange story, but it turns on a very simple fact, the same fact that runs through the tangled history of Harlan and the Michigan students. Korean Air did not succeed, it did not right itself, until it acknowledged the importance of its cultural legacy. Plane crashes rarely happen in real life the way they happen in the movies. Some engine part does not explode in a fiery bang. The rudder doesn't suddenly snap under the force of takeoff. The captain doesn't gasp, "Dear God," as he's thrown back against his seat. The typical commercial jetliner, at this point in its stage of development, is about as dependable as a toaster. Plane crashes are much more likely to be the result of an accumulation of minor malfunctions and extenuating circumstances. In a typical crash, for example, the weather is poor. Not terrible, necessarily, but bad enough that the pilot is under a little more stress than usual. In an overwhelming number of crashes, the plane is behind schedule, so the pilots are hurrying. In 52% of crashes, the pilot, at the time of the accident, has been awake for 12 hours or more, meaning that he's tired and not thinking straight. And 44% of the time, the two pilots have never flown together before, so they're not comfortable with each other. Then the errors start, and not just one error. The typical accident involves 7 consecutive human errors. One of the pilots does something wrong that by itself would not have been a problem. Then one of them makes another error on top of that, which, combined with the first error, still does not amount to catastrophe. But then they make a third error on top of that, and then another, and another, and another, and another. And it's the combination of all those errors that leads to disaster. These 7 errors, furthermore, are rarely problems of knowledge or flying skill. It's not that the pilot has to negotiate some critical technical maneuver and fails. The kinds of errors that cause plane crashes are invariably errors of teamwork and communication. One pilot knows something important and somehow doesn't tell the other pilot. One pilot does something wrong and the other pilot doesn't catch the error. A tricky situation needs to be resolved through a complex series of steps, and somehow the pilots fail to coordinate and miss one of them. The whole flight deck design is intended to be operated by 2 people, and that operation works best when you have one person checking the other, or both people willing to participate, says Earl Wiener, who for many years was chief engineer for safety at Boeing. Airplanes are very unforgiving if you don't do things right. And for a long time, it's been clear that if you have 2 people operating the plane cooperatively, you will have a safer operation than if you have a single pilot flying the plane and another person who's simply there to take over if the pilot is incapacitated. Consider, for example, the famous, in aviation circles anyway, crash of the Colombian airliner Avianca 052 in January of 1990. The Avianca accident so perfectly illustrates the characteristics of the modern plane crash that it is studied in flight schools. In fact, what happened to that flight is so similar to what would happen 7 years later in Guam that it's a good place to start our investigation into the mystery of Korean Air's plane crash problem. The captain of the plane was Laureano Cavieides. His first officer was Maurizio Klotz. They were en route from Medellin, Colombia, to New York City's Kennedy Airport. The weather that evening was poor. There was a nor'easter up and down the East Coast, bringing with it dense fog and high winds. 203 flights were delayed at Newark Airport. 200 flights were delayed at LaGuardia Airport, 161 at Philadelphia, 53 at Boston's Logan Airport, and 99 at Kennedy. Because of the weather, Avianca was held up by air traffic control 3 times on its way to New York. The plane circled over Norfolk, Virginia for 19 minutes, above Atlantic City for 29 minutes, and 40 miles south of Kennedy Airport for another 29 minutes. After an hour and a quarter of delay, Avianca was cleared for landing. As the plane came in on its final approach to landing, the pilots encountered severe wind shear. One moment they were flying into a strong headwind, forcing them to add extra power to maintain their momentum on the glide down. The next moment, without warning, the headwind dropped dramatically, and they were traveling much too fast to make the runway. Typically, the plane would have been flying on autopilot in that situation, which reacts immediately and appropriately to wind shear. But the autopilot on the plane was malfunctioning, and it had been switched off. At the last moment, the pilot pulled up and executed a go-around. The plane did a wide circle over Long Island and reapproached Kennedy Airport. Suddenly, one of the plane's engines failed. Seconds later, a second engine failed. "Show me the runway," the pilot cried out, hoping desperately that he was close enough to Kennedy to somehow glide his crippled plane to a safe landing. But Kennedy was 16 miles away. The 707 slammed into the estate owned by the father of the tennis champion John McEnroe in the posh Long Island town of Oyster Bay. 73 of the 158 passengers aboard died. It took less than a day for the cause of the crash to be determined. Fuel exhaustion. There was nothing wrong with the aircraft. There was nothing wrong with the airport. The pilots weren't drunk or high. The plane had run out of gas. "It's a classic case," said Surin Ratwadi, a veteran pilot with Emirates Airlines, who has been involved for years in human factors research, which is the analysis of how human beings interact with complex systems like airplanes. Ratwadi is Sri Lankan, a lively man in his 40s who has been flying commercial jets his entire adult life. We were sitting in the lobby of the Sheraton Hotel in Manhattan. He had just landed an Emirates jumbo jet at Kennedy Airport after a long flight from Dubai. Ratwadi knew the Avianca case well. He began to tick off the typical crash preconditions: the nor'easter, the delayed flight, the minor technical malfunction with the autopilot, the 3 long holding patterns, when air traffic control required the plane to circle round and round, which meant not only 80 minutes of extra flying time, but extra flying at low altitudes, where a plane burns far more fuel than it does in the thin air high above the clouds. They were flying a 707, which is an older airplane and is very challenging to fly, Ratwadi said. "That thing is a lot of work. The flight controls are not hydraulically powered. They are connected by a series of pulleys and pull rods to the physical metal surfaces of the airplane. You have to be quite strong to fly that airplane. You heave it around the sky. It's as much physical effort as rowing a boat. My current airplane, I fly with my fingertips. I use a joystick. My instruments are huge. Theirs were the size of coffee cups. And his autopilot was gone. So the captain had to keep looking around these 9 instruments, each the size of a coffee cup, while his right hand was controlling the speed and his left hand was flying the airplane. He was maxed out. He had no resources left to do anything else. That's what happens when you're tired. Your decision-making skills erode. You start missing things that you would pick up on any other day. In the black box recovered from the crash site, Captain Kevyedis, in the final hour of the flight, is heard to repeatedly ask for directions from ATC to be translated into Spanish, as if he no longer had the energy to make use of his English. On 9 occasions, he also asked for directions to be repeated. "Tell me things louder," he said, right near the end. "I'm not hearing them." When the plane was circling for 40 minutes just southeast of Kennedy, when everyone on the flight deck clearly knew they were running out of fuel, the pilot could easily have asked to land at Philadelphia, which was just 65 miles away. But he didn't. It was as if he had locked in on New York. On the aborted landing, the plane's ground proximity warning system went off no less than 15 times, telling the captain that he was bringing in the plane too low. He seemed oblivious. When he aborted the landing, he should have circled back around immediately and didn't. He was exhausted. Through it all, the cockpit was filled with a heavy silence. Sitting next to Kevyedis was his first officer, Maurizio Klotz, and in the flight recorder there were long stretches of nothing but rustling and engine noise. It was Klotz's responsibility to conduct all communication with ATC, which meant that his role that night was absolutely critical. But his behavior was oddly passive. It wasn't until the third holding pattern southwest of Kennedy Airport that Klotz told ATC that he didn't think the plane had enough fuel to reach an alternate airport. The next thing the crew heard from ATC was, "Just stand by," and, following that, "Clear to the Kennedy Airport." Investigators later surmised that the Avianca pilots must have assumed that ATC was jumping them to the head of the queue, in front of the dozens of other planes circling Kennedy. In fact, they weren't. They were just being added to the end of the line. It was a crucial misunderstanding upon which the fate of the plane would ultimately rest. But did the pilots raise the issue again, looking for clarification? No. Nor did they bring up the issue of fuel again for another 38 minutes. To Ratwadi, the silence in the cockpit made no sense. And as a way of explaining why, Ratwadi began to talk about what had happened to him that morning, on the way over from Dubai. "We had this lady in the back," he said. "We reckoned she was having a stroke, seizing, vomiting, in bad shape. She was an Indian lady whose daughter lives in the States. Her husband spoke no English, no Hindi, only Punjabi. No one could communicate with him. He looked like he had just walked off a village in the Punjab, and they had absolutely no money. I was actually over Moscow when it happened, but I knew we couldn't go to Moscow. I didn't know what would happen to these people if we did. I said to the first officer, 'You fly the plane. We have to go to Helsinki.'" The immediate problem Ratwadi faced is that they were less than halfway through a very long flight, which meant that they had far more fuel in their tanks than they usually do when it comes time to land. "We were 60 tons over maximum landing weight," he said. "So now I had to make a choice. I could dump the fuel, but countries hate it when you dump fuel. It's messy stuff, and they would have routed me somewhere over the Baltic Sea, and it would have taken me 40 minutes, and the lady probably would have died. So I decided to land anyway. My choice." That meant the plane was landing heavy. They couldn't use the automated landing system because it wasn't set up to handle a plane with that much weight. "At that stage, I took over the controls," Ratwadi went on. "I had to ensure that the airplane touched down very softly. Otherwise, there would have been a risk of structural damage. It could have been a real mess. There are also performance issues with landing heavy. If you clear the runway and have to go around, you may not have enough thrust to climb back up. It was a lot of work. You're juggling a lot of balls. You've got to get it right. Because it was a long flight, there were two other pilots. So I got them up, and they got involved in doing everything as well. We had four people up there, which really helped in coordinating everything. I'd never been to Helsinki before. I had no idea how the airport was, no idea whether the runways were long enough. I had to find an approach, figure out if we could land there, figure out the performance parameters, and tell the company what we were doing. At one point, I was talking to three different people, talking to Dubai, talking to Medlink, which is a service in Arizona where they put a doctor on call, and I was talking to the two doctors who were attending to the lady in the back. It was nonstop for 40 minutes. We were lucky the weather was very good in Helsinki," he continued. "Trying to do an approach in bad weather, plus a heavy plane, plus an unfamiliar airport, that's not good. Because it was Finland, a first world country, they were very well set up, very flexible. I said to them, I'm heavy. I would like to land into the wind. You want to slow yourself down in that situation. They said, no problem. They landed us in the opposite direction than they normally use. We came in over the city, which they usually avoid for noise reasons. Think about what was required of Ratwadi. He had to be a good pilot. That much goes without saying. He had to have the technical skill to land heavy. But almost everything else that Ratwadi did that made that emergency landing a success fell outside the strict definition of piloting skills. He had to weigh the risk of damaging his plane against the risk to the woman's life. And then, once that choice was made, he had to think through the implications for the sick passenger in the back of Helsinki versus Moscow. He had to educate himself, quickly, on the parameters of an airport he had never seen before. Could it handle one of the biggest jets in the sky at 60 tons over its normal landing weight? But most of all, he had to talk to the passengers, to the doctors, to his co-pilot, to the second crew he woke up from their nap, to his superiors back home in Dubai, to ATC at Helsinki. It's safe to say that in the 40 minutes that passed between the passenger's stroke and the landing in Helsinki, there was no more than a handful of seconds of silence in the cockpit. What was required of Ratwadi was that he communicate, and not just communicate in the sense of issuing commands, but communicate in the sense of encouraging and cajoling and calming and negotiating and sharing information in the clearest and most transparent manner possible. Here, by contrast, is a transcript from Avianca 052 as the plane is going in for its abortive first landing. The issue is the weather. The fog is so thick that Klotz and Caviatus cannot figure out where they are. Pay close attention, though, not to the content of their conversation, but to the form. In particular, note the length of the silences between utterances and the tone of Klotz's remarks. Caviatus. The runway. Where is it? I don't see it. I don't see it. They take up the landing gear. The captain tells Klotz to ask for another traffic pattern. 10 seconds pass. Caviatus. Seemingly to himself. We don't have fuel. 17 seconds pass as the pilots give technical instructions to each other. Caviatus. I don't know what happened with the runway. I didn't see it. Klotz. I didn't see it. Air traffic control comes in and tells them to make a left turn. Caviatus. Tell them we are in an emergency. Klotz. To air traffic control. That's right to 180 on the heading and, we'll try once again. We're running out of fuel. Imagine the scene in the cockpit. The plane is dangerously low on fuel. They have just blown their first shot at a landing. They have no idea how much longer the plane is capable of flying. The captain is desperate. Tell them we are in an emergency. And what does Klotz say? That's right to 180 on the heading and, we'll try once again. We're running out of fuel. To begin with, the phrase running out of fuel has no meaning in air traffic control terminology. All planes, as they approach their destination, are by definition running out of fuel. Did Klotz mean that 052 no longer had enough fuel to make it to another alternative airport? Did he mean that they were beginning to get worried about their fuel? Next, consider the structure of the critical sentence. Klotz begins with a routine acknowledgement of the instructions from air traffic control and doesn't mention his concern about fuel until the second half of the sentence. It's as if he were to say, in a restaurant, yes, I'll have some more coffee, and, I'm choking on a chicken bone. How seriously would the waiter take him? The air traffic controller who Klotz was speaking with testified later that, I just took it as a passing comment. On stormy nights, air traffic controllers hear pilots talking about running out of fuel all the time. Even the ah that Klotz inserts between the two halves of his sentence serves to undercut the importance of what he's saying. Klotz spoke, according to another of the controllers who handled 052 that night, in a very nonchalant manner. There was no urgency in the voice. The term used by linguists to describe what Klotz was engaging in that moment, is mitigated speech, which refers to any attempt to modify or sugarcoat the meaning of what's being said. We mitigate when we're being polite, or when we're ashamed, or embarrassed, or when we're being deferential to authority. If you want your boss to do you a favor, you don't say, "I'll need this by Monday." You mitigate. You say, "Don't bother if it's too much trouble, but if you have a chance to look at this over the weekend, that would be wonderful." In a situation like that, mitigation is entirely appropriate. In other situations, however, like a cockpit on a stormy night, it's a problem. The linguists Uta Fischer and Judith Arasano, for example, once gave the following hypothetical scenario to a group of captains and first officers and asked them how they would respond. You notice on the weather radar an area of heavy precipitation 25 miles ahead. The pilot is maintaining his present course at Mach 0.73, even though embedded thunderstorms have been reported in your area and you encounter moderate turbulence. You want to ensure that your aircraft will not penetrate this area. Question: what do you say to the pilot? In Fischer and Arasano's mind, there are at least six ways to try and persuade the pilot to change course and avoid the bad weather, each with different levels of mitigation. Number one, command: turn 30 degrees right. That's the most direct and explicit way of making a point imaginable. It's zero mitigation. Number two, crew obligation statement: I think we need to deviate right around now. Notice the use of we and the fact that the request is now much less specific. That's a little softer. Number three, crew suggestion: let's go around the weather. Implicit in that statement is, we're in this together. Number four, query: which direction would you like to deviate? That's even softer than a crew suggestion because the speaker is conceding that he's not in charge. Number five, preference: I think it would be wise to turn left or right. Number six, hint: that return at 25 miles looks mean. That's the most mitigated statement of all. Fischer and Arasano found that captains overwhelmingly said they would issue a command in that situation: turn 30 degrees right. They were talking to a subordinate. They had no fear of being blunt. The first officers, on the other hand, were talking to their boss, and so they overwhelmingly chose the most mitigated alternative. They hinted. It's hard to read Fischer and Arasano's study and not be just a little bit alarmed, because a hint is the hardest kind of request to decode and the easiest to refuse. In the 1982 Air Florida crash outside Washington, D.C., the first officer tried three times to tell the captain that the plane had a dangerous amount of ice on its wings. But listen to how he says it. It's all hints. First officer: look at how the ice is just hanging on his, back there. See that? Then, first officer tries again: see all those icicles on the back there and everything? And then, boy, this is a losing battle here on trying to de-ice those things. It gives you a false feeling of security. That's all that does. Finally, as they get clearance for takeoff, the first officer upgrades two notches to a crew suggestion: let's check those wingtips again, since we've been sitting here a while. Captain: I think we get to go here in a minute. The last thing the first officer says to the captain, just before the plane plunges into the Potomac River, is not a hint, a suggestion, or a command. It's a simple statement of fact. And this time, the captain agrees with him. First officer: Larry, we're going down, Larry. Captain: I know it. Mitigation explains one of the great anomalies of plane crashes. In commercial airlines, captains and first officers split the flying duties equally. But historically, crashes have been far more likely to happen when the captain is in the flying seat. At first, that seems to make no sense, since the captain is almost always the pilot with the most experience. But think about the Air Florida crash. If the first officer had been the captain, would he have hinted three times? No. He would have commanded, and the plane wouldn't have crashed. Planes are safer when the least experienced pilot is flying, because it means the second pilot isn't going to be afraid to speak up. Combating mitigation has become one of the great crusades in commercial aviation over the past 15 years. Every major airline now has what is called crew resource management training, which is designed to teach junior crew members how to communicate clearly and assertively. For example, many airlines teach a standardized procedure for co-pilots to challenge the pilot if he or she thinks something has gone terribly awry. Captain, I'm concerned about. Then, Captain, I'm uncomfortable with. And if the captain still doesn't respond, Captain, I believe the situation is unsafe. And if that fails, the first officer is required to take over the airplane. Aviation experts will tell you that it is the success of this war on mitigation as much as anything else that accounts for the extraordinary decline in airline accidents in recent years. On a very simple level, one of the things we insist upon at Emirates is that the first officer and the captain call each other by their first names, Ratwadi said. We think that helps. It's just harder to say, Captain, you're doing something wrong, than to use a name. Ratwadi took mitigation very seriously. You couldn't be a student of the Avianca crash and not feel that way. He went on, One thing I personally try to do is, I try to put myself a little down. I say to my co-pilots, I don't fly very often. 3 or 4 times a month, you fly a lot more. If you see me doing something stupid, it's because I don't fly very often. So tell me, help me out. Hopefully, that helps them speak up. Back to the cockpit of Avianca 052. The plane is now turning away from Kennedy, after the aborted first attempt at landing. Klotz has just been on the radio with air traffic control, trying to figure out when they can land again. Caviatus turns to him. Caviatus, what did he say? Klotz, I already advise him that we are going to attempt again because now we can't. 4 seconds of silence pass. Caviatus, advise him we are in emergency. 4 more seconds of silence pass. The captain tries again. Did you tell him? Klotz, yes, sir. I already advise him. Klotz starts talking to air traffic control, going over routine details. 150 maintaining 2000 Avianca 052 heavy. The captain is clearly at the edge of panic. Caviatus, advise him we don't have fuel. Klotz gets back on the radio with air traffic control. Climb and maintain 3000 and, we're running out of fuel, sir. There it is again. No mention of the magic word emergency, which is what air traffic controllers are trained to listen for. Just running out of fuel at the end of a sentence, preceded by the mitigating ah. If you're counting errors, the Avianca crew is now in double digits. Caviatus, did you already advise that we don't have fuel? Klotz, yes, sir. I already advise him. Caviatus, bueno. If it were not the prelude to a tragedy, their back and forth would resemble an Abbott and Costello comedy routine. A little over a minute passes. Air traffic control. And Avianca 052 heavy, I'm going to bring you about 50 miles northeast and then turn you back onto the approach. Is that okay with you and your fuel? Klotz, I guess so. Thank you very much. I guess so? Thank you very much? They're about to crash. One of the flight attendants enters the cockpit to find out how serious the situation is. The flight engineer points to the empty fuel gauge and makes a throat-cutting gesture with his finger. But he says nothing. Nor does anyone else for the next 5 minutes. There's radio chatter and routine business, and then the flight engineer cries out, Flame out on engine number 4. Caviatus says, Show me the runway. But the runway is 16 miles away. 36 seconds of silence pass. The plane's air traffic controller calls out one last time. You have enough fuel to make it to the airport? The transcript ends. The thing you have to understand about that crash, Ratwadi said, is that New York air traffic controllers are famous for being rude, aggressive, and bullying. They are also very good. They handle a phenomenal amount of traffic in a very constrained environment. There's a famous story about a pilot who got lost trafficking around JFK. You have no idea how easy it is to do that at JFK once you're on the ground. It's a maze. Anyway, a female controller got mad at him and said, Stop. Don't do anything. Do not talk to me until I talk to you. And she just left him there. Finally, the pilot picks up the microphone and says, Madam, was I married to you in a former life? They are unbelievable. The way they look at it, it's, I'm in control, shut up, and do what I say. They will snap at you. And if you don't like what they tell you to do, you have to snap back. And then they'll say, all right then. But if you don't, they'll railroad you. I remember a British Airways flight was going into New York. They were being stuffed around by New York air traffic control. The British pilot said, you people should go to Heathrow and learn how to control an airplane. It's all in the spirit. If you're not used to that sort of give and take, New York air traffic control can be very, very intimidating. And those Avianca guys were just intimidated by the rapid fire. It was impossible to imagine Ratwadi not making his case to Kennedy air traffic control, not because he was obnoxious or pushy or had an enormous ego, but because he saw the world differently. If he needed help in the cockpit, he would wake up the second crew. If he thought Moscow was wrong, well, he would just go to Helsinki. And if Helsinki was going to bring him in with the wind, well, he was going to talk them into bringing him in against the wind. That morning, when they were leaving Helsinki, he had lined up the plane on the wrong runway, and his first officer had quickly pointed out the error. The memory made Ratwadi laugh. Masse is Swiss. He was very happy to correct me. He was giving me shit the whole way back. Ratwadi continued, all the guy had to do was tell the controller, we don't have the fuel to comply with what you are trying to do. All they had to do was say, we can't do that. We have to land in the next 10 minutes. They weren't able to put that across to the controller. It was clear that Ratwadi was speaking carefully, because he was making the kind of cultural generalization that often leaves us uncomfortable. But what happened with Avianca was just so strange, so inexplicable, that it demanded a more complete explanation than simply that Klotz was incompetent and the captain was tired. There was something more profound, more structural going on in that cockpit. What if there was something about the pilots being Colombian that led to that crash? Look, no American pilot would put up with that. That's the thing, Ratwadi said. They would just say, listen, buddy, I have to land. In the 1960s and 1970s, the Dutch psychologist Gert Hofstede was working for the Human Resources Department of IBM's European headquarters. Hofstede's job was to travel the globe, interviewing employees, asking questions about things like how people solve problems and how they work together and what their attitudes were to authority. The questionnaires were long and involved, and over time Hofstede was able to develop an enormous database for analyzing the ways in which cultures differ from one another. Today, Hofstede's dimensions are one of the most widely used paradigms in cross-cultural psychology. Hofstede argued, for example, that cultures can be usefully distinguished according to how much they expect individuals to look after themselves. He called that the individualism-collectivism scale. The country that scores the highest on the individualism end of that scale is the United States. Not surprisingly, the United States is also the only industrialized country in the world that does not provide its citizens with universal health care. At the opposite end of that scale is Guatemala. Another of Hofstede's dimensions is uncertainty avoidance. How well does a culture tolerate ambiguity? Here are the top five uncertainty avoidance countries according to Hofstede's database, that is, the countries most reliant on rules and plans and most likely to stick to procedure regardless of circumstances. Number one, Greece. Number two, Portugal. Number three, Guatemala. Number four, Uruguay. Number five, Belgium. The bottom five, that is, the cultures best able to tolerate ambiguity, are number 49, Hong Kong, number 50, Sweden, number 51, Denmark, number 52, Jamaica, number 53, Singapore. It is important to note that Hofstede wasn't suggesting that there was a right place or a wrong place to be on any one of those scales. Nor was he saying that a culture's position on one of his dimensions was an ironclad predictor of how someone from that country behaves. It's not impossible, for example, for someone from Guatemala to be highly individualistic. What he was saying instead was something very similar to what Nisbet and Cohen argued after their hallway studies at the University of Michigan. Each of us has his or her own distinctive personality, but overlaid on top of that are tendencies and assumptions and reflexes handed down to us by the history of the community we grew up in. And these differences are extraordinarily specific. Belgium and Denmark are only an hour or so apart by airplane, for example. Danes look a lot like Belgians, and if I dropped you on a street corner in Copenhagen, it wouldn't look all that different from a street corner in Brussels. But when it comes to uncertainty avoidance, they could not be further apart. In fact, Danes have more in common with Jamaicans when it comes to tolerating ambiguity than they do with some of their European peers. Denmark and Belgium may share in a kind of broad European liberal democratic tradition, but they have different histories, different political structures, different religious traditions, different languages and food and architecture and literature going back hundreds and hundreds of years. And the sum total of all those differences is that in certain kinds of situations that require dealing with risk and uncertainty, Danes tend to react in a very different way from Belgians. Of all of Hofstede's dimensions, though, perhaps the most interesting is what he called the Power Distance Index, PDI. Power distance is concerned with attitudes towards hierarchy, specifically with how much a particular culture values and respects authority. To measure it, Hofstede asks questions like, how frequently, in your experience, does the following problem occur? Employees being afraid to express disagreement with their managers. In other words, to what extent do the less powerful members of organizations and institutions accept and expect that power is distributed unequally? How much are older people respected and feared? Are power holders entitled to special privileges? In low power distance index countries, Hofstede wrote in his classic text, Culture's Consequences, power is something of which power holders are almost ashamed, and they will try to underplay. I once heard a Swedish, low PDI, university official state that in order to exercise power, he tried not to look powerful. Leaders may enhance their informal status by renouncing formal symbols. In low PDI Austria, Prime Minister Bruno Kreisky was known to sometimes take the streetcar to work. In 1974, I actually saw the Dutch, low PDI, Prime Minister Joop den Uyl on vacation with his motorhome at a camping site in Portugal. Such behavior of the powerful would be very unlikely in high PDI Belgium or France. It's hard to imagine the prime minister of either country in a streetcar or a motorhome. You can imagine the effect that Hofstede's findings had on people in the aviation industry. What was their great battle over mitigated speech and teamwork all about, after all? It was an attempt to reduce power distance in the cockpit. Hofstede's questions about power distance, how frequently, in your experience, does the following problem occur, employees being afraid to express disagreement with their managers, was the very question aviation experts were asking of first officers in their dealings with captains. And Hofstede's work suggested something that had not occurred to anyone in the aviation world, that the task of convincing first officers to assert themselves was going to depend an awful lot on their culture's power distance rating. That's what Ratwadi meant when he said that no American would have been so fatally intimidated by the controllers at Kennedy Airport. America is a classic low-power distance culture. When push comes to shove, Americans fall back on their Americanness. And that Americanness means that you think of the air traffic controller as your equal. But what country do you find at the other end of the power distance scale? Colombia. In the wake of the Avianca crash, the psychologist Robert Helmreich, who has done more than anyone to argue for the role of culture in explaining pilot behavior, wrote a brilliant analysis of the accident in which he argued that you couldn't understand Klotz's behavior without first taking into account his nationality. That his predicament that day was uniquely the predicament of someone who had a deep and abiding respect for authority. Helmreich wrote, "The high power distance of Colombians could have created frustration on the part of the first officer because the captain failed to show the kind of clear, if not autocratic, decision-making expected in high power distance cultures. The first and second officers may have been waiting for the captain to make decisions, but still may have been unwilling to pose alternatives." Klotz sees himself as a subordinate. It's not his job to solve the crisis. It's the captain's. And the captain is exhausted and isn't saying anything. Then there's the domineering Kennedy Airport air traffic controllers ordering the planes around. Klotz is trying to tell them that he's in trouble, But he's using his own cultural language, speaking as a subordinate would to a superior. The controllers, though, aren't Colombian. They're low-power distance New Yorkers. They don't see any hierarchical gap between themselves and the pilots in the air, and to them, mitigated speech from a pilot doesn't mean the speaker is being appropriately deferential to a superior. It means that the pilot doesn't have a problem. There is a point in the transcript where the cultural miscommunication between the controllers and Klotz becomes so evident that it is almost painful to read. It's the last exchange between Avianca and the control tower, just minutes before the crash. Klotz has just said, "I guess so, thank you very much," in response to the controller's question about their fuel state. Captain Cavietis then turns to Klotz. Cavietis, "What did he say?" Klotz, "The guy is angry." Angry? Klotz's feelings are hurt. His plane is moments from disaster, but he cannot escape the dynamic dictated to him by his culture, in which subordinates must respect the dictates of their superiors. In his mind, he has tried and failed to communicate his plight, and his only conclusion is that he must have somehow offended his superiors in the control tower. In the aftermath of the Kennedy crash, the management of Avianca Airlines held a postmortem. Avianca had just had four accidents in quick succession, and all four cases, the airline concluded, had to do with airplanes in perfect flight condition, aircrew without physical limitations and considered of average or above average flight ability, and still the accidents happened. In the company's Madrid crash, the report went on, the co-pilot tried to warn the captain about how dangerous the situation was. The co-pilot was right, but they died because when the co-pilot asked questions, his implied suggestions were very weak. The captain's reply was to ignore him totally. Perhaps the co-pilot did not want to appear rebellious, questioning the judgment of the captain, or he did not want to play the fool because he knew the pilot had a great deal of experience flying in that area. The co-pilot should have advocated for his own opinions in a stronger way. Our ability to succeed at what we do is powerfully bound up in where we're from, and being a good pilot and coming from a high power distance culture is a difficult mix. Colombia, by no means, has the highest PDI of all, by the way. Helmreich and a colleague, Ashley Merritt, once measured the PDI of pilots from around the world. Number one was Brazil. Number two with South Korea. The National Transportation Safety Board, the U.S. agency responsible for investigating plane crashes, is headquartered in a squat 70-era office building on the banks of the Potomac River in Washington, D.C. Off the agency's long hallways are laboratories filled with airplane wreckage, a mangled piece of an engine turbine, a problematic piece of a helicopter rotor. On a shelf, in one of the laboratories, is the cockpit voice and data recorder, the so-called black box, from the devastating ValueJet crash in Florida in 1996, where 110 people were killed. The recorder is encased in a shoebox-sized housing made out of thick, hardened steel, and on one end of the box there is a jagged hole, as if someone, or rather something, had driven a stake into it with tremendous force. Some of the NTSB investigators are engineers who reconstruct crashes from the material evidence. Others are pilots. A surprising number of them, though, are psychologists, whose job it is to listen to the cockpit recorder and reconstruct what was said and done by the flight crew in the final minutes before a crash. One of the NTSB's leading black box specialists is a gangly 50-ish PhD psychologist named Malcolm Brenner. And Brenner was one of the investigators on the Korean Air crash in Guam. "Normally that approach into Guam is not difficult," Brenner began. "Guam Airport had what is called a glide scope, which is like a giant beam of light stretching up into the sky from the airport, and the pilot simply follows the beam all the way down to the runway. But on this particular night, the glide scope was down. It was out of service," Brenner said. "It had been sent to another island to be repaired, so there was a notice to airmen that the glide scope was not operating. In the grand scheme of things, this should not have been a big problem. In the month the glide scope had been under repair, there had been something like 1,500 safe landings at Guam Airport. It was a small thing, an inconvenience really, that made the task of landing a plane just a little bit more difficult. The second complication was the weather, Brenner continued. Normally in the South Pacific, you've got these brief weather situations, but they go by quickly. You don't have storms. It's a tropical paradise. But that night, there were some little cells, and it just happens that that evening they were going to be flying into one of those little cells a few miles from the airport. So the captain has to decide, what exactly is my procedure for landing? Well, they were cleared for what's called a VOR-DME approach. It's complicated. It's a pain in the ass. It takes a lot of coordination to set it up. You have to come down in steps. But then, as it happens, from miles out, the captain sees the lights of Guam. So he relaxes, and he says, we're doing a visual approach. The VOR is a beacon that sends out a signal that allows the pilots to calculate their altitude as they approach an airport. It's what pilots would rely on before the invention of the glidescope. The captain's strategy was to use the VOR to get the plane close, and then once he could see the lights of the runway, to land the plane visually. Pilots do visual landings all the time. It seemed to make sense. But every time a pilot chooses a plan, he's supposed to prepare a backup in case things go awry, and this captain didn't. They should have been coordinating. He should have been briefing for the DME step-downs, Brenner went on, but he doesn't talk about that. The storm cells are all around them, and what the captain seems to be doing is assuming that at some point he's going to break out of the clouds and see the airport. And if he doesn't see it by 560 feet, he'll just go around. Now, that would work, except for one thing. The VOR on which he's basing his strategy is not at the airport. It's 2.5 miles away on Nimitz Hill. There are a number of airports in the world where this is true. Sometimes you can follow the VOR down, and it takes you straight to the airport. Here, if you follow the VOR down, it takes you straight to Nimitz Hill. The pilot knew about the VOR. It was clearly stated in the airport's navigational charts. He'd flown into Guam 8 times before, and in fact, he had specifically mentioned it in the briefing he gave before takeoff. But then again, it was 1 in the morning, and he'd been up since 6 a.m. the previous day. We believe that fatigue was involved, Brenner went on. It's a back-of-the-clock flight. You fly in and arrive at 1 in the morning, Korea time. Then you spend a few hours on the ground, and you fly back as the sun is coming up. The captain has flown it a month before. In that case, he slept on a first-class seat. Now he's flying in and says he's really tired. So there they are, the classic preconditions of a plane crash. The same 3 that set the stage for Avianca 052. By themselves, none of these would be sufficient for an accident. Together, they require the combined efforts of everyone in the cockpit, and that's where Korean Air 801 ran into trouble. Here is the flight recorder transcript of the final 30 minutes of KAL Flight 801. It begins with the captain complaining of exhaustion. 1:20 and 1 second. Captain, if this round trip is more than a 9-hour trip, we might get a little something. With 8 hours, we get nothing. 8 hours do not help us at all. They make us work to maximum, up to maximum. Probably this way, hotel expenses will be saved for cabin crews and maximized to flight hours. Anyway, they make us work to the maximum. There's the sound of a man shifting in his seat. A minute passes. 1:21 and 13 seconds. Captain, really sleepy. First officer, of course. Then comes one of the most critical moments in the flight. The first officer decides to speak up. First officer, don't you think it rains more in this area here? The first officer must have thought long and hard before making that comment. He was not flying in the easy collegiality of Surin Ratwadi's cockpit. Among Korean Air flight crews, the expectation on layovers was that the junior officers would attend to the captain to the point of making him dinner or purchasing him gifts. As one Korean Air pilot puts it, the sensibility in many of the airline's cockpits was that the captain is in charge and does what he wants, when he likes, how he likes, and everyone else sits quietly and does nothing. In the Delta report on Korean Air that was posted anonymously on the internet, one of the auditors tells a story of sitting in on a Korean Air flight where the first officer got confused while listening to air traffic control and mistakenly put the